Welcome to the Deep Dive. I am so glad you're joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Because we are looking at a story that is just packed with creative chaos.
Oh, absolutely, and massive corporate risk-taking.
Right. It's a journey that fundamentally changed an entire industry. We are talking about Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
Specifically, its translation from a beloved animated film to an absolute juggernaut on the Broadway stage.
Exactly. And our source for today's deep dive is the comprehensive Wikipedia article on the musical.
It's a really thorough breakdown.
It is. And our mission today, we want to uncover exactly how a concept that so many people, even some of its own cast members, called a terrible idea, transformed into a 13-year smash hit.
A hit that completely rewrote the rules of live theater. It really is a phenomenal case study to dig into.
I mean, it's wild when you think about it.
It is, because this isn't just a simple story about a fairy tale coming to life on stage. When you look at the mechanics of how this happened, it's a masterclass in the art of adaptation.
Yeah, and it's about a massive corporation stepping completely out of its comfort zone.
Exactly, taking a huge financial and creative gamble. And perhaps most compellingly, for anyone who follows the arts, it is the ultimate clash between traditional elite theater critics and raw, undeniable audience
The
demand.
stakes were so high.
Incredibly high, both for the creators at Disney and for the Broadway establishment itself.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand the magnitude of this leap, we have to go back to the origins.
Right, back to the animated studio struggles.
Yeah, following Walt Disney's death, the animation studio was genuinely struggling. They were in this serious, widely documented slump through the 70s and 80s.
But then enter Michael Eisner as the new CEO.
Yes. Now, Eisner had virtually no animation experience, but what he did have was a background as a college theater major.
Which completely shifted their approach.
It really did. He brings in a theatrical producer named Peter Schneider, and together they start bringing in people with stage backgrounds to make movies.
Instead of traditional animators leading the charge.
Exactly. And this leads them to the brilliant composer Alan Menken and lyricist Howard Ashman.
The dream team.
Oh, totally. Their highly theatrical approach to The Little Mermaid completely reignites the studio. It sparks what we now know as the Disney Renaissance.
And that theatrical energy leads right into the creation of the animated Beauty and the Beast, which, as the source material details, carries a deeply poignant and tragic detail behind the scenes.
Yeah, this part is really tough.
It is. While working on this joyous, beautiful film, Howard Ashman was secretly dying of AIDS.
It's so heartbreaking.
He actually kept his illness a secret from the studio for a long time, out of a very real fear of discrimination or losing his job.
Which was such a valid fear at the time.
Unfortunately, yes. He was actually being cared for at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York while the film was premiering at the New York Film Festival.
Wow. It's incredibly sobering to think about. He was pouring all this life and magic into the score while his own health was failing.
Exactly. Tragically, he passed away just months before the film's massively successful wide release in November of 1991.
Just months before.
Yeah. It was the last project he and Alan Menken worked on together. He never got to see the global phenomenon the film became, let alone the theatrical revolution his music would eventually spark.
Yeah, we really have to pause and acknowledge that bittersweet reality. Because the music they created together ended up being the ultimate catalyst for the stage show.
It was the driving force.
Right. So the animated film comes out, and it makes history. It's the first animated film ever nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars.
Which was unheard of.
Completely. But the real turning point for Broadway actually comes from a review by Frank Rich.
Ah, the famous New York Times review.
Yes. When Rich reviewed the film for the Times, he basically lamented the overall state of Broadway at the time. And he specifically praised Menken and Ashman.
He made a pretty bold claim, right?
Very bold. He wrote that the animated film featured the best Broadway musical score of 1991. He was openly saying a cartoon had better music than anything actually playing on stage that year.
What's fascinating here is how that single piece of criticism functioned as a green light.
It really did.
That one review from a prestigious critic gave Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg the confidence to seriously consider pushing Disney into the live theater space.
Because they were looking at the massive profits of Broadway spectacles running at the time.
Exactly. The mega musicals, Cats, Les Miserables, The Phantom of the Opera, they realized they had the IP to tap into that market.
But having the intellectual property and knowing how to mount a Broadway show are two very different things.
Very different.
Right. And their approach to finding a director was highly unconventional. They were so protective of their vision that they purposefully decided against hiring an A-list established Broadway director.
They didn't want anyone to step on their toes.
Exactly. They worried an industry veteran might try to overpower them or challenge the Disney brand. So instead, they went with Robert Jess Roth,
who was virtually unknown in the Broadway world.
The complete unknown. His main claim to fame was directing live shows at the Disney theme parks.
Which is quite a jump from theme parks to Broadway.
Huge jump. Roth had actually pitched a Mary Poppins stage show to Eisner years earlier and got rejected.
Oh, I did know that.
Yeah. But Eisner liked his theme park work, so he gave him a shot to pitch Beauty and the Beast. So Roth goes to a hotel room in Aspen, Colorado.
Of course, an Aspen hotel room.
Right. Very 90s corporate. And he pitches Eisner and Katzenberg using 140 storyboards, costume sketches, fabric swatches.
Unloading the whole vision.
And a demonstration of a single stage illusion. And it works. On the strength of that hotel room pitch, they greenlight Disney's first ever Broadway venture.
But the skepticism outside that room in Aspen was deafening. The traditional theater world looked at this project with sheer disbelief.
They thought it was a joke.
They really did. Theatrical producers, like Steven Susskind, were on the record thinking that adapting a movie to the stage was entirely backward.
Because the standard was always stage to screen.
Exactly. The conventional wisdom of the era was that a story should work in the theater first, and then maybe it gets adapted into a movie. Taking a finished, globally beloved animated film and trying to put it on a Broadway stage was seen by the establishment as a doomed gimmick.
They genuinely believed audiences wouldn't accept a live version of something so deeply ingrained in their minds as a cartoon.
It was a massive structural headache.
Oh, yeah. Taking a perfectly paced 84-minute movie and stretching it into a two-act live show, here's where it gets really interesting.
I love this part.
So the creative team reaches out to Linda Wolverton, who wrote the original animated screenplay.
Right.
She's vacationing in Maui with her family when Disney commissions her to adapt her script for Broadway. And her initial, very honest reaction was simply, yikes.
That's a fair reaction.
Totally fair. She had to write a full-length stage libretto, the actual script and dialogue moving the songs along, which meant giving the characters far more emotional depth to justify a 2.5-hour runtime.
And her most brilliant playwriting modification for the stage was a mechanical change regarding the enchanted objects.
The servants.
Yes. In the animated film, the servants are already fully transformed into a teapot, a clock, a candelabra. It's an established fact. But for the stage libretto, Wolverton made the enchantress's spell gradual.
Oh, that's right.
The staff are humans who are slowly turning into inanimate objects over the course of the story. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this wasn't just a clever visual trick to explain why human actors were walking around in object costumes.
Right. It added a vital, dramatic ticking clock to the narrative.
Exactly. Becoming fully inanimate meant death. They were losing their humanity piece by piece.
That subtle shift completely elevated the stakes.
It forced the audience to care deeply about the supporting characters, which is why minor film characters were expanded into fully realized roles with actual names.
Like Babette the Feather Duster.
Yes, and Madame de la Grande Bouche the Wardrobe. Their survival was now literally on the line.
And to support this expanded story in these deeper emotional arcs, they needed more music.
Yeah, truly.
Alan Menken returned, but obviously he was now without Howard Ashman. So Menken teams up with lyricist Tim Rice,
who had actually stepped in to replace Ashman on the rest of the Aladdin film as well.
Exactly. Both Menken and Rice were hesitant at first. Menken was understandably fiercely protective of his work with Ashman, and Rice was terrified of ruining what many considered a perfect score.
But they made it work.
They did. They ended up adding 6 brand new songs to the show to focus on character development. For example, they gave the Beast a powerful act. One closer called If I Can't Love Her.
Such a great song.
It really is. Plus, they resurrected Human Again, a song Ashman and Menken had originally written for the film, but cut for time.
The evolution of the music didn't even stop once the show opened. There is a fantastic piece of Broadway trivia in the sources regarding a song that was added years later.
Oh, the Toni Braxton story. This is incredible.
It really highlights the chaos of live theater.
So, 4 years into the Broadway run, R&B singer Toni Braxton is cast, making history as the first African-American belle on Broadway.
A huge milestone.
Yeah. She was negotiating her contract, but kept delaying the final signature. Finally, she has dinner with Menken, Rice, and the choreographer. She agrees to sign, but only on the condition that they write a brand new song specifically for her.
Which is a massive ask.
And Tim Rice, who admitted he was a bit intoxicated at this dinner.
Oh, no.
He drunkenly promises her that they will absolutely do it.
Which is a bold promise to make for an established running Broadway show.
Exactly. A few days later, the director, Robert Jess Roth, finds out from Tony Braxton about this promise and essentially confronts Rice.
I can only imagine that conversation.
Right. Within 24 hours, Rice had to frantically figure out where in the plot to even put a new song.
Where did he end up putting it?
He realized he could place it in Act Two, where Belle explains to her father how her time in the castle has changed her. That became the song A Change in Me, and it was so well received that it has remained in the musical ever since.
It's a perfect example of the chaotic, on-the-fly, creative problem-solving that defines live theater.
Totally.
But as challenging as the writing and the music composition were, the physical production was a totally different beast. Pun intended.
Very nice. Yeah. Yeah, the physical production sounded genuinely grueling. Let's talk about casting and costuming.
Okay.
For the lead role of Belle, they cast a 22-year-old actress named Susan Egan, who was making her Broadway debut. Now, remember what we said about people thinking this was a bad idea?
Yeah, the skepticism.
Egan herself actually thought putting a cartoon on Broadway was a terrible idea.
Really? The star thought it was a bad idea.
Yes. She had been auditioning for classic, established shows like My Fair Lady in Greece, which she was much more interested in. She didn't even think she was attractive enough to play a character whose name literally translates to beauty.
But that reluctance and the fact that she hadn't constantly watched the film to memorize it actually gave her an edge in the audition room.
How so?
Well, the producer saw 500 other actresses who came in just doing flawless imitations of the original voice actress, Paige O'Hara.
Oh, just copying the movie, exactly.
Right. But Egan didn't do that. She played Belle as quirky and funny. She approached it as a straight ingenue, a classic, innocent, leading lady type, but brought a unique comedic sensibility that made the producers laugh.
So she won the role because she was doing something original with the character.
Exactly. She wasn't just doing a cartoon impression.
She was acting originally, sure, but Disney initially mandated that the costumes had to be exact. Carbon copy replicas of the movie.
Which is a nightmare for a stage designer.
A total nightmare. Anne Holdsworth was the costume designer, and she had a nearly impossible task trying to translate 2D animation into real life.
It's just not practical.
Not at all. Let me just give you the shocking physical reality of what these actors were dealing with. Belle's famous yellow ball gown, it weighed 45 pounds.
Wait, 45 pounds? For a dress? How is a 22-year-old making her Broadway debut even moving in that, let alone singing and dancing?
Barely. It was made of massive hoop skirts, silk, beading, and heavy brocade, that really dense woven fabric.
It sounds exhausting.
It was so enormous it couldn't even fit into Egan's dressing room door. After the scene, three backstage crew members had to use wires to hoist the dress up into the theater rafters just to store it safely out of the way.
That is absurd. And yet the actors playing the enchanted objects had it even worse.
Oh, the prosthetics.
Yeah. The studio initially didn't trust the audience's ability to suspend their disbelief. So instead of theatrical suggestion, they piled on heavy prosthetics and massive structural frames to make the actors look exactly like the cartoon objects.
Right. Gary Beach, who played Lumiere, the candelabra, had to carry two actual real propane tanks on his hands to feed the flames.
That sounds dangerous.
It was. He said it was like walking around carrying two hams around a grocery store for 2.5 hours every night.
Two hams.
And during one performance, his hand literally caught on fire.
You're joking.
No. And he didn't even notice until Terrence Mann, playing the Beast, started frantically nodding at his hand to warn him.
That is terrifying.
And speaking of Terrence Mann, his Beast costume was horrific to wear. He compared the heat and weight of it to wearing several heavy winter coats. He said the wig felt like taking four Angora cats, taping them to your head, and running around the block a dozen times.
I can't even imagine the sweat.
And Beth Fowler, who played Mrs. Potts the teapot, had a costume that required her to keep one arm raised constantly to act as the spout. The production literally had chiropractors and physical therapists on standby backstage just to deal with the physical toll it took on her body.
It was completely unsustainable. Thankfully, as they went through their out-of-town previews in Houston, the creative team and Disney finally relented.
They had to.
They realized that the massive prosthetics were actively limiting the actor's ability to sing, breathe, and act. So they gradually reduced the heavy rubber and started relying more on traditional theater makeup and smarter costume design.
Which is just better theater.
It is. This is a crucial lesson in medium translation. Film, especially animation, demands literal visual perfection. You draw exactly what the audience sees. But theater relies on the audience's active imagination.
Right.
By scaling back the literalism, they finally trusted that a live theater audience would buy into the illusion. They learned the hard way that a stage show cannot simply be a carbon copy of a film.
So what does this all mean? All the pain, the money, the burned hands, the 45-pound dresses.
Yes.
They finally make it to opening night on Broadway in 1994, and the traditional theater critics did not hold back.
They really didn't.
They absolutely tore the show apart. The New York Times dismissed it as relentlessly bland and robot-like.
Ouch.
Other critics called it a theme park attraction, a kiddie show, a dinner theater production, completely devoid of imagination. It was universally panned by the old guard.
The tension between Disney and the establishment was palpable.
It was so high that Disney even got into a public spat with the legendary Broadway artist Al Hirschfeld.
Over the drawing, right.
Yes. Hirschfeld drew one of his famous line drawings for the show's review, but he purposefully colored Belle's dress pink instead of yellow, and the Beast's tuxedo greenish instead of blue.
Just to be petty.
Kind of. When Disney complained to him about the inaccuracy, Hirschfeld basically told them to get lost, saying, the costumes may have been blue and yellow, they make you feel green and pink.
The establishment rejected it completely, from the reviews to the caricatures. But here is the counter-narrative, and it is arguably the most important part of this entire deep dive.
Let's hear it.
The audiences simply didn't care what the critics said.
Not one bit.
The production resonated with the public and with families on a scale Broadway had rarely, if ever, seen. This raises an important question. Who is theater actually for?
That's the million-dollar question.
For a century, Broadway was heavily curated by a handful of families and elite critics who dictated what was a good show. But Beauty and the Beast bypassed those gatekeepers entirely.
It ran on Broadway for 13 years.
Logging an astounding 5,461 performances.
Unbelievable.
It grossed over $1.7 billion worldwide, playing in 13 countries. It proved definitively that a show could survive, and in fact thrive, on Broadway despite unenthusiastic reviews, as long as the audience felt a genuine emotional connection to the material.
And its legacy is just impossible to overstate today. Stuart Oaken, a theatrical producer, noted that Disney's success with this one single show is directly responsible for today's biggest Broadway hits.
It opened the floodgates.
It really did. Once Michael Eisner realized the model worked and the gatekeepers didn't matter, Disney brought in The Lion King, Mary Poppins, Newsies, Aladdin, Frozen. It completely disrupted the theatrical establishment.
But beyond just the Disney brand, Beauty and the Beast is widely considered Broadway's first legitimate family show.
Which is crazy to think about now.
Right. It birthed an entirely new demographic of theatergoers. Think about it. If a 10-year-old girl went to see Susan Egan as Belle in 1995, she was the teenager buying tickets to Wicked or Hairspray in 2003.
And she was the adult buying tickets to Legally Blonde or Matilda years later.
Exactly. It directly paved the way for the youth and female-driven hits that dominate modern theater box offices.
Before we wrap up, I want to connect this journey directly back to you listening right now. Think about your own life, your team, or your career. Think about a time you took a massive risk on an idea that everyone else, all the established experts, called a terrible idea.
We've all been there.
We have. The story of Beauty and the Beast shows that sometimes ignoring the traditional gatekeepers, enduring the painful growing pains, and simply trusting your audience is the key to creating a lasting legacy.
You don't always need the critics to applaud you if the people you're actually trying to reach are showing up.
That's entirely true. When we synthesize this whole journey, Beauty and the Beast teaches us that successful adaptation isn't about perfectly replicating the source material.
It's about knowing exactly what core emotional elements to keep, like the central romance, the incredible Menken score, and being brave enough to change things for a new medium.
Like adding the ticking clock of the servant's transformation.
Or allowing the actors to actually act instead of burying them in rubber. It is a testament to the power of knowing your medium and trusting your performers to carry the story.
It really is. But it also leaves us with a tough, lingering question. If the massive billion-dollar success of family-friendly, corporate-backed spectacles like Beauty and the Beast paved the way for modern Broadway and ultimately saved it financially,
What happens to the weird, quiet, experimental art trying to get a stage today?
Exactly. How does that Disneyfication impact the original, smaller, adult-oriented stories, trying to find funding in an ecosystem dominated by massive IP? Has the definition of what makes a Broadway show permanently changed forever?
It is definitely something to think about next time you look up at a glowing Broadway marquee.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We loved unpacking this incredible story with you, and we will catch you on the next one. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.